During the Level 4 lockdown, we interviewed Toby Muse about his book Kilo, his inside investigation of Colombia's cocaine cartels. And cocaine piggybacks, by and large, along the established trade routes of the world, and Toby told us the supply had diminished and the price had gone up. What other effects has the pandemic had on organised crime is the question, and the answer is quite a few. Journalist Misha Glennie is the author of McMafia, and in that book, he concluded that international organised crime could account for 15% of the world's GDP. He's been a visiting professor at Columbia University, teaching the subject crime in transition. He's advised American and European governments, and his book Dark Market focused on cybercrime. Misha was the BBC's foreign correspondent in Eastern Europe, and many of the organised crime networks he has investigated have been the ones that grew out of the collapse of the Soviet Union. He spent a lot of time with major criminals, including a famous drug lord in Rio, Antonio Lopez, who ran its largest favela. And that experience became the book Nemesis, One Man and the Battle for Rio. The confusing and increasingly less and less transparent world of crime is one that Misha Glennie moves easily and bravely through. Hello, Misha.
Hello.
Organised crime. We can see how some of it's been stymied by the pandemic, Misha, but adapting well. I'm just going to get a broad picture, if I can, first on how you think organised crime is going.
Well, it depends which sector you're looking at. So there was an immediate panic, mainly in the narcotics sector, because drugs basically became the toilet rolls of the illicit world. When everyone realized that lockdown was coming, there was a huge scramble, and this was all over the world where drugs are taken, for people to get their stashes in before lockdown. And then, of course, the major thing is a further shift, an acceleration to online sales of narcotics, which are then delivered by Amazon, DHL, and all the other courier services around the world. So that is likely to remain after lockdown. Another significant percentage increase of narcotics sold online, and that actually changes the nature of the business, because online sales tend to be more distributed, tend to be decentralized, and so it actually works against the really big organized crime cartels who traditionally control the drugs trade. So that's one thing that's been going on. And the main thing you saw was a huge increase in fraudulent websites and sales of non-existent or counterfeit PPE, personal protective equipment, and also scams on the internet, which were playing on people's anxieties and lack of knowledge about it. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of schemes around the world that were playing on those anxieties. Now, that's something that always happens when you have a crisis or when you have scarcity, when you have uncertainty. We are facing in the long term an immense economic crisis, a tsunami, which is going to hit us over the next 18 months, and we're going to feel it like we've never felt anything before. Now, in that case, when you have severe disruption to the economy, this is the greatest opportunity for organized crime to assert themselves as part of the social fabric. There will be a shortage of supply of various goods and services. China is starting to be slightly selective about what it will sell to whom, because it feels aggrieved at the way that it's being treated by the United States. And in that case, organized crime moves in and fills up the gaps. So throughout those areas where organized crime is already well established, whether it's in Eastern Europe, whether it's in Southern Europe, whether it's in Central and South America. Organized crime has already expanded its activity and its control over local communities everywhere.
Yeah, I want to get back into the local. But your vocation, your mission really is to explain to us how the world, the underbelly of the world works. And you've spent a lot of time with major criminals, many of them East European. You've told us how organized crime mediated the Soviet Union's emergence into capitalism as the oligarchs seized all the assets. Are we going to see a further globalizing, a further burgeoning of crime internationally as well as locally, please?
Well, that depends on how things emerge politically. If up until 2008, the main phenomenon was an expansion of organized crime from places where it had hitherto barely existed, like the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and so on, but also curious places like Indonesia, southern China is a big organized crime hub as well. What you've been seeing in the past 10, 15 years is organized crime moving into the bigger centers of power, in particular the United States. They buy influence. And in the United Kingdom, for example, our big problem here, and this government, like previous governments, shows no interest in doing anything about it, is we have become the biggest money laundering casino in the world. And in particular, the London property market is a center of money laundering for oligarchs, for organized crime, for corrupt politicians. And with governments around the world scrabbling for money, mired in debt, this will give those people who have access to large sums of money, and that includes big organized crime groups like the Mexican cartels, for example, this will give them huge leverage. And they will use the very instruments that big business has been using, offshore tax havens, to exert their influence and continue to launder their money.
And there will be so much impoverishment in certain societies, and people also newly impoverished, and cost-cutting in the institutions that bolster society in places. You would think there are huge opportunities for all sorts of corruption, actually.
There are. I look at the case of the favela, the slum in Rio de Janeiro, where I lived, researching the man who had previously run the favela, about 100,000 people, as the head of the cocaine cartel there. And what was interesting, he's now in jail and another cartel has taken over. But what was really interesting about that is that when the lockdown started, the cartel in Rocinha, the favela, because the Brazilian president is a pandemic denier, the cartel themselves told the residents of Rocinha that they would have to lock down, that there would be a curfew, and they, the cartel, were going to manage it. Because in areas like Rio or in parts of Mexico, the state is either unwilling or unable to manage society. And so organized crime does it instead. And that means including doing things for the benefit of the community, like making sure that they lock down. And I think, as we saw in southern Italy as well, that is going to increase as the search for money becomes more desperate over the next 12 to 18 months or so. Now, in somewhere like New Zealand, now, of course, you're entirely cut off with very little movement in and out of the country, or certainly in the country, apart from Australia. You're a long way away. You have various gangs that operate within New Zealand on a sort of social level, but you are not a big hub for organized criminal activity, largely because you're too far away from everywhere. And so you are likely to be safe for a long time until people realize that New Zealand is a really good place to go.
Yes, and we've seen our share of it, but of course nothing on the scale that you see. It's interesting.
That's right.
That business of Antonio Lopez, whom you've written about, fascinatingly, and the man who ran the biggest favela in Rio and did it better than the government, looked after its people better than the local government.
The government,
could.
Yeah.
That can happen on a scale that is big, like his scale, but that's also little, can't it? I mean, as aspects of society break down, you've shone a light on the criminal mind before, and top criminals aren't just forever thinking of dirty deeds to do. And one of the reasons so many of them have talked to you is that they believe they serve their communities. Yeah,
That's true. That's how they. That's always how they tend to justify what they're doing. Of course, their primary business is to make money, and it is to make money by breaking the law. When push comes to shove, they have to use violence. So without violence, you can't be involved in organized crime. Otherwise, they see it as a business that, you know, they're buying and selling stuff, which happens to be illicit, or they're controlling markets. So depending on where you are in the chain of the organized crime business, your risk changes and you act differently. Sometimes you pick up semi-automatics and use them. Sometimes you pass a brown envelope to a local judge or a local cop, and your path is smooth that way.
Just harking back to your remarks about America earlier, I mean, corruption has always existed in democracies, and there's been all sorts of wheeling and dealing in America over the years, and a lot of it illegal, and we know that. I'm just curious about how you think there is greater corruption there now, without turning it into yet another Donald Trump assessment. What do you think is happening to America in the sense of it becoming more corrupt?
Well, the chief reason goes back to my mind, to the year 2010, 2 years after the great crash, when the Supreme Court found in favor of the appeal of an organization called Citizens United. And what Citizens United was actually the opposite of that sort of touchy-feely title it had. Citizens United wanted to allow corporations to have the status of individuals when it came to giving money to American politicians seeking elections. And that has distorted and corrupted American politics more than anything else. And that's why it's now very easy for corrupt Ukrainians or Saudis or South Africans to give money through various channels, to give money to their politicians and then demand favors later on. So that is the one big thing. There's one thing, Jim, that we haven't mentioned yet, which is important. And it's something that I really want to highlight because it relates to COVID in a big way. And that is, over the past 15 years or so, one of the greatest increases in criminal activity is around the trade in endangered species.
Yeah.
And this has been driven primarily by the Chinese market, although a big sub-market has developed in Vietnam. And that's partly because the Chinese authorities have, to their credit, cracked down somewhat on the illegal trade in things like ivory, things like tiger and lion bones, in the terrible trade in pangolins, a curious animal which has scales that are made out of keratin, which is the same as our fingernails, but which Chinese medicine deems to have special powers, which it does not. It has no medicinal powers whatsoever. And we have seen the almost total destruction of the rhinoceros population in Africa, East and South Africa, and also a precipitous drop in the number of elephants as well. And the reason why this is important is because, of course, COVID is most likely to have been a zoonotic disease, i.e. it jumps species. And the biggest suspicion, if ever you've been to a Chinese wet market, which I have, it is absolutely horrifying to see all of these various different types of animals in incredibly close quarters, caged up, you know, biting, snapping, spitting and everything. And many of these animals have been imported illegally into China. And this has got to stop, because if you look at the rate of pandemics that we've had as a consequence of illegal trafficking like this, Ebola, HIV, and coronavirus are all thought to have been zoonotic diseases associated with the consumption of meat of endangered species. But you'll get people from the Czech Republic, for example, you'll get people from the United States who are helping with the transit of all of this stuff through to East Asia. And it is one of the biggest threats that we face, but on the whole, very underreported. In particular, if you see this gradual but inexorable trend towards moving organized crime from the real world onto the virtual world and online, police forces are having to switch their model appropriately. And that means they have to employ many more people who are computer savvy, who are cybersecurity engineers or computer engineers. And the trouble with that, unfortunately, there is a dearth of cybersecurity engineers around the world. And so if you are a good cybersecurity engineer, you can earn 50, 60, 70, 80,000 pounds sterling. That's up to 200,000 New Zealand dollars. And the police just can't pay that. So they can't get the good talent that they need. And good cyber criminals and good traditional organized crime people who have now expanded and now include a cyber division in their operations are in a position to run rings around law enforcement as a consequence of this.
In the book Dark Market, you unveiled the new mafia, the cyber crims, and the opportunities being presented for them now seem considerable. So do you worry that they'll become entrenched and with a power, a new power that we should be scared of? Because we've often heard that cybercrime is fragmented, a bit like the cocaine trade in Colombia, and attempts to make it cohere have failed. And so the nightmare would be a sort of shadow cyber state that has the visible state at its mercy. Can that happen to any extent?
At the moment, not without a state backing it. So when it comes to cyber, you have a lot of low-level cybercrime. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit on the net if you're minded to snatch it as a cyber criminal. Not necessarily a hacker. Hackers are a relatively small part of cyber criminal activity. Most people involved in cybercrime are what we call social engineers. They're people who are persuading you to do silly things with your computers by getting you to click onto a link and then you'll download malware. But what has grown up in the past 10 years is organized hacking groups who target companies, usually not just major corporations, but small and medium companies as well. On the rise is ransomware, and ransomware has been devastating organizations, institutions, governments, companies all over the world. So there's a lot of easy money to be made there. And as we know, in Asia, we had about 4 years ago the attack on the Bangladeshi Central Bank, which netted the criminals around $80 million, which was the largest hack ever in terms of the money. They very nearly got away with $2 billion. They were a few minutes away from actually getting a huge amount of money as well. So there are big organizations and big money that can be made. But if you're looking at that level, you're looking at people who have state backing. The real problem we face at the moment is that in cyber, there is no international regulation, no international governance of the cyber infrastructure, no rules of the road. And as a consequence, the main players, the United States, Europe, Russia, China, increasingly Israel and Iran as well, in your neck of the woods, Australia is quite powerful in this as well. The main players are developing a whole array of offensive weaponry. Some of them, the Chinese deploy them regularly for espionage purposes. it's very chaotic, very cacophonous out in the digital world at the moment. And unless there is some sort of agreement between the major players about how you regulate the internet cleverly, then this is what's opening up the possibilities for criminals. You don't need to be a cyber criminal yourself. You can get in touch with someone over the dark web. Believe me, it's very easy to get in touch with these people over the dark web and say, look, can I hire you to attack my business competitor for the next 3 days with a denial of service attack? And they'll say, sure, that'll be $2,000. You pay the $2,000 in Bitcoin, and then they attack your competitor, and your competitor loses custom, and you gain it. This sort of thing is going on all the time.
Look, the battle between the cops and the robbers has been going on forever. I suppose we look ahead and think that it will just continue, albeit in a different way. But do you think the coronavirus is going to have a profound effect on the shape of organized crime?
This virus is like nothing any of us have seen before. We have never, as a world, seen governments go into so much debt and to spend so much money in just keeping the whole thing afloat. We're entering into a period that is entirely unknown to us. And so making any firm predictions is, to my mind, unwise. But I think one thing you can say is that where the opportunity arises, criminal activity, and particularly well-organized criminal activity, is going to be there, it's going to be very present, and it's going to find ways to make a lot of money, in as much that any money still exists.
But just finally, the depressing point, as you discovered with your bloke in the Rio favela, who had monkeys he washed in baby shampoo. He was an entertaining character. And, of course, he was forced into crime, wasn't he? I mean, that's a very sad story. Because you tell us the story of how he became a crime lord. And I wonder, as an exemplary kind of tale for what might happen, a kind of microcosm, I wonder if you could just explain what drove him into crime.
Well, what happened to Antonio was when he was about 26 years old, he was brought up in poverty. His father died of a gunshot wound when he was 12 years old. And he got a job. He had a wife. He never had anything to do with the drugs trade. And then when he was 25, he and his wife, Vanessa, had a daughter. And after 10 months, she became very, very ill. And after desperately going around Rio trying to get her illness diagnosed, it was finally discovered that she suffered from something called histiocytosis X. And this is a very rare disease. And in order to treat the disease, he required equipment and medicines from the United States. And he didn't have the money to buy those. So the only way he could save his daughter's life was to go and borrow the money from the guy who ran the favela at the time, the then don of the favela. And the only way he could pay that money back was to go and work for the favela don. So he had this Hobson's choice of, you either let your daughter die or you go and work for the local drugs cartel. And he happened to be naturally a very smart guy, quite a sort of wise entrepreneurial thinker. And he made his way, admittedly with a few very nasty shootouts on the way, to the top of the business. And because he was such a successful businessman, he managed to get the support of most of the favela.
Perfect cautionary tale. Are you generally optimistic that the world's going to be a better place when this all shakes down, or you just don't know?
Do you know what? It's a very important question. It's 50-50. If we don't cooperate on these things, then I think that, you know, we're not long for this world as a species. But this is the opportunity. Coronavirus has shone a light on the way the world works like nothing else. So now we're in a position to say, okay, guys, we either all pull together on this one, or we're up a creek without a paddle.
We're toast. Thank you so much for your time, Misha. Lovely to talk to you.
You're welcome.
Misha Glennie.